The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
The following broadcast has been approved for Elite Hornets fans.
What a block by Cody Zeller.
Walker down the lane. Drive, shoot, scores! Game over!
Bringing back the buzz was only the beginning.
We will not go quietly into the night.
It's Hornets talk for the hardcore fan. It's Hive Talk Live.
Welcome in, Hornets fans. You are listening to Hive Talk Live on atthehive.com. It's Hornets Talk for the hardcore fan. We are live in the Gittimer.com studios in BEA, beautiful uptown Charlotte. I'm Doug Branson.
And I'm David Walker, Doug. I'm searching for something to say here, and it's not coming. I've been searching all day. This morning. I'm sorry I missed you on our mini pod this morning.
That's okay. You're giving me the Ross Geller from Friends.
Hi.
Coming up, guys, would Kobe Bryant have played for the Hornets after they drafted him in 1996? Plus, what did Al Jefferson, a prep-to-pro star, struggle with most in his transition to the NBA? And Nick Denning is here. He's a little bit older, a little bit wiser, and he knows what's happening around the NBA. And with that, we say, let's swarm Charlotte. I mean, we would be remiss, I think, as basketball fans, as basketball aficionados, to not mention the basketball game that happened last night. One of the best NCAA, even though the result isn't, I think, what either of us wanted. That's beside the point. That was an amazing finish in the UNC Villanova NCAA championship game.
Yeah, I mean, let's just so what you're saying, you want to just relive, you know, one of the worst nights of my life.
That's good. Well, no, I don't want to. I'll roll some. I can roll some sad music for you.
Just hit me with the drop that I've been screaming in my head all day, please. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, does that make you feel better?
Take it down. I'm just.
But we should talk about this.
All right.
And here's why.
I mean, I got some stuff to talk about if you want to talk about some stuff.
I want to talk about Villanova because I think that Villanova did in that game and really that whole tournament what Golden State has done in a sense in the NBA, and that's thrive off of chaos.
Body check people?
Scrambling, pushing the ball.
I'm kidding.
Villanova taking the fans. Shot when they had an opportunity to take a shot. And this has been the year of chaos in basketball. And, you know, in a sense, on both defense and offense, that's what Villanova did.
They had a great game plan. I think both teams had a pretty good game plan. Look, it was a three-point game. So, and it came down to a long-range three-point shot that will be replayed every March, if not every other month in the calendar year for the next, forever.
For UNC,
so we can look forward to that.
For UNC, I think that's probably – only set in terms of worst things that could have happened to
that's the one.
The
that's the worst.
No, I think it's the second worst. Cause losing to Duke in the tournament has always been the nightmare.
That would be the universe collapsing.
Because at that point, Duke would have, and even losing to State would be really tough. But I want to go back to this idea of the year of chaos. So when UNC made their comeback, it was really because Villanova started to try to wind time down. And they started to stall and get out of that chaotic motion. And that's when UNC was able to get some defensive stops. But when Villanova was moving all around the floor and just causing absolute chaos on offense and defense, that's when that team thrived. And
well, it's not like they were speeding the game up at any point, though. I mean, they weren't exactly
flying
the ball off the floor. You're just saying
well,
the
they
half were,
no, well, hold on. Because I think they weren't necessarily trying to get out into transition, but they were pushing the ball and they were taking Yeah, they were. That's what they did to Oklahoma. Every time they took the ball out, they pushed the ball up the floor.
They walked it up a lot. They walked it up a lot last night, if I recall correctly. You don't think so?
Well, your memories are damaged.
Well,
no, I think they tried. The intensity that they showed on offense and defense screamed chaos to me.
I think in the half court, I think they were walking the ball up a lot more. I mean, they wanted to slow it down. They didn't want to run with Carolina, though. I don't think necessarily, not the whole game.
I think it should.
I mean, they tried to. I think they were more aggressive on defense in the full court than they were on offense.
I think it should be a warning to teams like the Charlotte Hornets that a team that's undersized could come in and take away what UNC did so well, which was dominate the paint,
mm-hmm.
get inside. That was their bread and butter. And Villanova was able to game plan them out of that game. And if you're the Charlotte Hornets, it's kind of the opposite. You're very good at taking 3-point shots, but will a team come along and completely take that out of your game?
Well, you know, in the postseason, you know, it's not going to be that easy on offense for the Hornets getting to that. But can we just real quick, can we run down a list of, I don't know, complaints from your NCAA broadcast real quick, or just presentation? Let me just say this. Is there any reason, Doug, that you see it fit to have the baselines of the court 5 different colors and multiple lines running across the corners of that thing? Do you know what I'm talking about? The graphics along, not to mention it's raised up 10 feet off of the ground.
Oh,
that's great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's great. So we can, you know, look at from that angle, like we're in the gutter.
The presentation of the championship, it's so different from the Final Four. It's so different from any other basketball
is there any other championship arena that is played in? You're not playing.
The student section is like 100 feet back.
There's no other sport that plays the championship game in an arena that is not built for said sport.
Well, there's no other sport that plays games on a battleship either.
true. And this is not like complaints about the game or the result. This is just in general. Like,
you've already had those.
I've got plenty of them, but I'm just saying like that is stupid. That's not going anywhere though. Like we can get over that. I think the court thing is weird. Remember like a couple of years ago when they had these massive decals on the court?
And
like,
Roy Williams, the coach of UNC, was very adamant about getting rid of those.
People were flying all over the place. So they got rid of those. That's good. I just think when you mess with like the lines and stuff, I mean, no one else talked about it. But if you'll remember back in the Syracuse game, there were a couple of times where people stepped out of bounds that wasn't called. And I don't know if that has anything to do with lines and colors. But when you're looking at the baseline, you need to be able to discern it, you know, out of the corner of your eye. So that's just a little pet peeve for me. Not to mention cutting to the images of the fans after every made basket. Not the fans in the arena, mind you. The fans in the home sites of the arena.
Well, the ones in Villanova who are participating in some kind of rave.
Was that a flash? Yeah, it was a rave, right?
Some kind
I thought
of
bubbles were going to come down.
Filled rave. Okay, we got to get to this interview. This is a big interview. We've been pubbing it all week. We sat down with Jonathan Abrams, author of the book Boys Among Men. It's all about the history of the high school directly into the NBA transition. And it has a longer history than you think, but the main part of this history is from 1995 until 2005. Extremely interesting conversation with Jonathan. Let's go to it. So are you tired of hearing about how great your book is yet?
You know, the funny thing is, like, I'm not used to talking this much. So that's been interesting, is trying to, like, I don't know how people like Stephen A. keep their energy up for so long. I guess it's a lot of fake madness or whatever.
Lots and lots of Red Bull.
Yes.
And drugs. No, I'm kidding.
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, no, it's been a fun experience. And when you're, you know, when I was writing it, it's really isolating to write a book. You know, when you're done, you don't know what the reception or reaction is going to be. So to see it been pretty positive has been really, really gratifying.
Well, both David and I love the book. Fantastic read. I loved how you weaved the different stories of each individual player, but also incorporated the different angles of all of the players involved. What made you want to write about the move from high school basketball directly to the NBA?
So I was a senior in high school in 2001. So that was the same year that Kwame Brown, Tyson Chandler, and Eddie Curry were high school seniors. So I was a basketball fan back then and pretty much following their careers in real time. And you hear all the stories about how Kwame is going to be this next all-star and Eddie Curry is the next Shaquille O'Neal, Tyson Chandler is the next Kevin Garnett. And you fast forward more than a decade later and I'm covering the league and it's almost like what happened to these guys and where was the proclamations for these guys different from the reality? So that was one. And then also for Grantland, I had done a few profiles on high school to pro guys and it just seemed like, you know, even the average NBA guys who had made the jump from high school, take a guy like Gerald Green, it seemed like his path to just respectability was a lot tougher than the average guy. I mean, just in his example, he had to go play in Siberia before he kind of gained the maturity to become an NBA rotation player. So I think it was those two combinations.
Most fans know the major names of players who went prep to pro: Kobe Bryant, Kevin Garnett, LeBron James, Dwight Howard. But what's the most fascinating to you that people don't know generally about the journey from prep to pro that maybe gets lost when people discuss this subject?
I think especially for the success stories, it's just crazy to me the amount of dedication and maturation it took to be able to do that, because, you know, I know where I was at 18 and if I was subjected to fame and money and popularity at that point in time, it would have, I don't know where I would have ended up. A lot of that can go to one's head and just divert them in life. You look at your life in high school and it's pretty much regimented. You're going to class, you're going to practice, you're going to do homework, you're going home. When you go to the NBA, you have a lot of free time now on your hands. You practicing only for a couple hours a day, most days, and then, you know, you have money for the first time and time for the first time. And that's a recipe for disaster for a lot of people. And I think using that time to master their craft is the thing that kind of separated the guys who made it from some of the guys who didn't.
With the 13th pick in the 1996 NBA draft, the Charlotte Hornets select Kobe Bryant from Lower Merion High School in Pennsylvania.
You profile Kobe Bryant and his entrance from prep to pro in 1996. Kobe Bryant inextricably linked with the Charlotte Hornets franchise. The Hornets selected Kobe Bryant with the 13th selection in the 1996 draft. Of course, as most of our listeners know, the Hornets had an arrangement with the Los Angeles Lakers to trade Kobe. What our listeners might not know, and what you write about, is that the deal almost fell through. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the deal was a contingent on Vlade Divac accepting a trade to Charlotte. And I grew up in Southern California, so I remember this in real time too. I was kind of sad about Vlade leaving because Vlade was a cornerstone to the Lakers. And even though Shaquille O'Neal was coming, Vlade was really ingrained in the Los Angeles community. He was a good guy that everybody liked and appreciated and enjoyed. So seeing him traded for a high school player that nobody had really heard of at that time was pretty much of a shock. And Vlade for a while threatened and contemplated retiring instead of reporting to Charlotte. His family was from overseas and had made their homes in Los Angeles and had never lived outside of Los Angeles in the United States. So he really, really contemplated whether to retire, which would have just completely nullified that trade. Jerry West, the Lakers GM, wanted Bob Bass to just agree to it and they could convince Vlade later, but Bob Bass said, no way. And basically, Vlade decided the Lakers had been good for him, so he didn't want to just nullify this trade and negate this trade when the Lakers thought that they could become a much better organization.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Jonathan, but I get the sense from reading your account that the fact that the Hornets and the Lakers had a backdoor deal in place helped Kobe Bryant fall as far as he did.
Yeah, because basically once the Lakers had shown interest in Kobe Bryant, his agent, Arden Tellem, stopped his workout. So Kobe didn't work out for maybe about half the teams that had those first 12 picks, and he didn't work out for the Hornets. So Bob Bass said that he wasn't going to take Kobe at all because he hadn't seen him play. So he had no plans of keeping him. And that was the same for a number of teams. And it was really interesting the way that Arden Tellem was able to manipulate that draft in order to get Kobe down to the 13th pick, because that would never, ever, ever happen in this day and age.
So the idea that Kobe Bryant likes to float around is that the Hornets never wanted him. But in your conversations with Bass, it sounds like that Kobe kind of honed in on one team and didn't really want any of the rest of the teams.
Yeah, he wanted to go to Los Angeles. And, you know, the biggest hurdle was the Nets with that 8th pick. Their GM, John Nash, really wanted to draft Kobe, but he was overruled by John Calipari, who was the team's president and coach at the time, just coming out of being a college coach. And he was kind of frightened off drafting a high school player at that time. It's something that John Nash really, really regrets to this day. I think another interesting facet about this is that the Hornets got better when they traded for Vlade for that in the immediate returns. I think Bob Bass won Executive of the Year after making that trade.
Yeah, and I think it's important, Jonathan, that we understand, like, hindsight is always 20/20. And even after Kevin Garnett was drafted a year prior out of high school, it seems like a lot of the GMs and a lot of the front offices were still struggling with the idea that a prep star could make the transition into the NBA. Is that correct?
Yeah, without a doubt. And a couple factors went into it. Only a handful of guys had made the jump before. In the 70s, it was Moses Malone, Hero Dawkins, and Bill Willoughby, and then Sean Kemp is kind of – he enrolled in college, but he never played for a college team, so he's kind of in that class. And then it was Kevin Garnett. So that was five big guys who had made that jump. So Kobe was the biggest guard, and the thinking was that the big guys could assimilate into the NBA faster just because their bodies would allow them to. So there was that skepticism over Kobe. And then also – you know, I think the biggest example of teams still being skeptical over it is that the Timberwolves could have taken Kobe. They just had the success with KG the year before. KG wasn't the MVP KG, obviously, yet, but he had shown that he had staying power in the league and he was going to grow and keep working to get better. But the Timberwolves didn't want to kind of tempt fate twice in consecutive years and ended up taking Stephon Marbury that year.
In communicating with Bob Bass, who again was the general manager of the Charlotte Hornets in 1996 when they selected Kobe Bryant in the draft, in the communications with him, did you sense any kind of lingering regret about not – I mean, there was a handshake deal, but there was no concrete deal with the Lakers in place. Did you sense any lingering regret about not keeping Kobe Bryant?
There's probably a – he's probably tired of hearing about it. And his thing was, you know, if everybody knew that Kobe Bryant was going to be Kobe Bryant, there were 12 other teams that could have taken him before they even had the pick. And, you know, to turn a 13th pick into a starting center who's pretty, pretty good in this league that's not too bad of a draft. You know, other guys got that Vitaly Podopinko and Todd Fuller before Kobe Bryant was off the board.
So we know from, and also reading in your book, Kobe Bryant made some maybe direct or veiled threats to possibly play overseas if another team took him before there was an opportunity for him to go to the Los Angeles Lakers. Do you think that had Bob Bass gone back on the deal with the Lakers and kept Kobe Bryant, do you think Kobe would have played in Charlotte?
Yeah, he would have, without a doubt. And he's even admitted in the years since that it was all a big bluff and he would have played with the Nets or the Hornets or whoever would have drafted him. You know, at that time, his dream was to play in the NBA.
All right, let's move on from Kobe Bryant to a player he tried to imitate, dominate, overcome. He now owns the Charlotte Hornets. His name, of course, Michael Jordan. You write a lot about him in this book. As an executive with Washington, he drafted prep star Kwame Brown, number one overall in 2001. Was he locked into Kwame Brown from the beginning of the draft preparations, or what was the lead up to that number one overall pick like?
No, he wasn't. He was. They had focused on the three big high school guys at that time: Eddie Curry, Kwame Brown, and Tyson Chandler. And those three guys had a lot of workouts before NBA draft teams. It was kind of like a three-headed race hitting down that wire. And basically, there was one big final workout, Kwame against Tyson Chandler, where they were already leaning toward drafting Kwame, but they kind of just wanted to have one last look. And Tyson Chandler left that workout kind of feeling that the Wizards were going to draft Kwame, feeling like he didn't have his best day in the gym and that Kwame got the better of him that day. And that's what ended up happening, is that they ended up drafting Kwame.
Now, a lot of people, a lot of fans, I think maybe before the Anthony Bennett selection, thought that this was quite possibly the worst number one pick of all time. But in reading your book, it seems a lot more complicated than that. And it gets very complicated when Michael Jordan decides to join the Washington Wizards and become Kwame Brown's teammate. How much do you think that aspect of the story did more damage to Kwame Brown than this idea that you talked about earlier in the interview, this proclamation over reality? What do you think, in your mind, what did more harm to Kwame Brown's career?
Yeah, I think it was a lot of different influences, and I think his relationship with Michael Jordan kind of veered suddenly. Michael went from being a kind of mentor, kind of playful guy who would kind of oversee Kwame's growth, to being a very, very demanding teammate. And we all know Michael Jordan liked to test his teammates by putting them in pressure-packed situations and kind of testing their resolve to see if they would be there late in the game. So Kwame, being a teenager, he just really couldn't handle that. And you know, I don't think there's many of us who would be able to.
I can attest to that. I certainly wouldn't be able to handle MJ's pressure cooker. But Kwame Brown would reunite with Michael Jordan and Rod Higgins, who was also with the Wizards organization at the time, in Charlotte for a nice stint with the then Charlotte Bobcats. How does Kwame Brown's persistence and his legacy as that first number one overall pick from prep to pro, what do you think that signals about that generation of prep to pro guys, that Kwame was able to stick it out, carve a niche?
Well, it's funny because I think we look at Kwame's career as a disappointment because he didn't live up to being a number one draft pick and didn't live up to being the guy that Michael Jordan handpicked to take in the draft. Where if you take a step back and you look at it and say, hey, if Kwame had gone to the University of Florida for a year, you know, may have had a couple of his weaknesses exposed against better competition. Say he's a late lottery pick, late team pick. We would look at his career a whole lot differently. He played a dozen years in the NBA, and he was a pretty good – he just played way, way more and way longer than the average NBA career. So I think if we look at it from that perspective, we get a whole different measure of how we view Kwame Brown.
Having written about several of Michael Jordan's missteps, Jonathan, how do you view his recent success as owner of the Charlotte Hornets?
I think he's finding a groove, and it's taking a little while. I like where they're headed, and I like where they're going, and I like Coach Clifford a lot. You know, they had some disasters with Dunlap, and I don't think Silas was the best position for that guy, and everybody knows what kind of happened with Larry Brown. So I like where it's going.
Hornets power forward Marvin Williams was on the Hangtime podcast with Sekou Smith, and he said he was glad he had 1 year in college, and his biggest reason was the lessons he learned from Roy Williams and the North Carolina staff on training like a pro, eating like a pro. And those things, Jonathan, they seem like simple things, like learning how to eat properly. But guys you wrote about in this book, they struggled with those simple things. What went into that, do you think?
I mean, the NBA back in the height of this was a lot different than the NBA is now, where, I mean, they didn't really have anybody to hold their hands off the court. And that's a huge adjustment. You're living it away from home for the first time in, of your life. You know, some guys, it was the first time they had ever opened a bank account. So they're just really, really getting experienced and exposed to life for the first time, a lot of them. So think about all the transition that they make, have to make off the court, and then think about all the transition they have to make away from the court, where, I mean, that's just a lot coming at you. I think now the NBA is a whole lot smarter, where they have developmental coaches and they have people who will tell you where to live, tell you where to eat, those type of things that kind of really help complete the transition, rather than just throwing the player into it and saying, you're a professional now, let's go.
Again, this is a great book, showed all angles, players, AAU teams, colleges, prep academies, families, and the pro organizations that drafted these prep stars. With so many involved, is it impossible to point to a boogeyman that ended the prep to pro tunnel in 2006?
Yeah, that's difficult, because once again, there's a lot of different influences and factors. I think one of the biggest things that I think needs to be corrected is that there's a lot of people who have a stake in the success of the players who made it, and a lot of people willing to credit for guys who became superstars, when nobody is really willing to accept the blame and responsibility of guys who didn't make it, whether it's the NCAA, the NBA, agents, coaches, et cetera, where I just think there needs to be some type of culpability for it. You know, and I'm not even absolving the players, but, you know, they were teenagers, and when they had that chance to kind of make a name for themselves, you try and grab that as soon as you can.
Well, we're coming up on new collective bargaining agreement talks. Michael Jordan involved heavily in those talks, as reported. Where do you hope that the conversation on the age limit rule heads in this next collective bargaining agreement?
I mean, in a perfect world, they come up with some type of baseball-like rule where guys can either come out of high school, or if they go to college, they have to stay for at least 2 years. And I think that way they'll be much closer toward getting a college degree than this. You can't even call it one and done. It's just a few months and done. And in that sense, also, a guy like Ben Simmons, he didn't really help anybody by going to LSU for just 1 year. He didn't help himself. He didn't help his school or his program, other than just more money coming in for these first few months. But it's not like you can say that program is better off by hosting them for a few months. So, I mean, I would like to see that, but I doubt it'll happen.
He's Jonathan Abrams. The book is Boys Among Men. Get it now. We just touched the surface with this line of questioning. There's so much more in the book. So many great stories. Thank you, Jonathan, for joining us.
I appreciate it.
Good interview.
So good, Doug.
Great. No, it has nothing to do with
that
me.
That was the questioning, the pace.
No, listen.
The warmth.
I feel like I really pushed the floor on that podcast.
Hey, he's a cool guy. I mean, he's done every podcast in the known universe, he had to check ours off his list.
Yeah,
but
right.
It was cool to have him in here.
Yeah, it was, and it's a great book. A lot of fantastic stories that we won't spoil that we didn't get into.
Great
in
book.
In that interview. And I think he laid some interesting points out there at the end of that interview about, you know, some possible solutions, because, again, this is coming up in collective bargaining agreement. And I think everyone – on either side of the argument of whether prep stars should be able to go straight to the NBA can agree that the one and done system is not really
not working.
It's not helping college basketball. It's not necessarily helping the NBA in any significant way than before the rule change. So, you know, if you're on the NBA side, I think you want to extend this thing to 2 years. If you're on the side of the prep stars, then you don't want to see that. Where do you fall on this
I think it makes sense for – I think guys should be able to go. If they're good enough to go, they should be able to go. But
this is America, right?
This is America, right?
Yeah.
This isn't Russia, is it?
No.
Okay.
Yet.
Yeah, I think they should be able to go. But I also think it's ridiculous that if you – let's say you go try out for the – you know, declare for the draft, don't get drafted. Well, sorry, can't get back to school. I mean, you know, so there's parts of that that's silly, right?
Yeah, it feels like guys are kind of boxed in a sense, and it just it doesn't seem there has to be, and I when Jonathan laid this out like an MLB type farm system, or and I think the NBA, it's like the NBA instituted this rule change, and they didn't really have the other systems in place yet. Like if there were a really substantial D League system or some kind of international system that could help these kids who don't necessarily belong in college, don't want to be in college, but there isn't. Like if you go to the D League out of high school, you're setting yourself behind the eight ball in terms of money.
Yeah.
And in terms of the way you're viewed, you know, the way your game is viewed. And a lot of that,
Europe's the route to go, I guess, if you're going to go that route.
Brandon Jennings or did that. But I think it would be even harder to do that. And again, once you come into the NBA, you don't get the same advantages that you would get if you're able to enter the draft. You're behind the eight ball. You don't get that guaranteed money. You don't get on that rookie scale.
So Simmons had to go to college, right? Because he went to school in Florida, I believe, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like he had to go to college. But Dante Exum did not have to go because he didn't get a high school here, right?
Right. And the rule is 19
or your high school graduating class
removed 1 year from high school.
But if you didn't go like this kid, in Canada who's petitioning to
Don Maker.
This is actually the recruiting portion of the show.
Mm.
The draft portion.
Yeah. I haven't done my research yet. Leave me alone.
But yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's a bit ridiculous. I think the baseball format is the one people are most familiar with, so it's probably the one that's most comfortable. And I don't think you're going to come up with a solution that's going to be perfect, because you don't want guys coming out that aren't ready. So, I mean, that's the catch 22, right? You want people to be able to go, but there are some guys that need to go to college if they can.
Okay.
You don't
Maybe.
Think?
I don't know.
What do you mean? You don't think there's guys that benefit Bryce Johnson?
I think if you want to go to college, then it can benefit you.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's anyone that needs to go to college. I don't think that there's one guy you go, that guy really needs an econ class.
No, I'm talking about just for basketball.
Oh.
Yeah. No. I'm not saying everyone has to go to college.
Well,
today.
But that's the thing. If that's the case, then they're not going to get drafted. It's all a crap. What I'm saying is whether you come out of high school, 1 year of college, or 4 years of college, it's all a crapshoot. You're not – anyway, I'm already spoiling what's coming up next. So we did this. Go ahead.
Last thing. There are kids, especially in this book, their story Abrams writes about guys we've never heard of. I've still never heard of that declared and didn't get drafted, right?
Well, again, I don't want to spoil too much of the book, but a lot of this is the guys around in the AAU systems that are around these kids that push them when they're not ready. And that's what you have to try to get rid of. But I don't know that it's worth taking away the opportunity from the kids that are ready.
Yeah.
Okay. So we decided for this week's Inside the Locker Room segment to ask a couple of guys their opinions on all of the situations, including Al Jefferson, who is a prep to pro star. And this is our first – we're pretty proud of this. This is our first full kind of feature piece. So take a listen. From 1995 to 2005, 39 young men went to sleep one night as high school basketball superstars, only to wake up the next day and become NBA professionals. Kobe Bryant may have put on a Hornets hat in 1996, but only one of this elite club has ever put on the teal and purple.
With the 15th pick in the 2004 NBA draft, the Boston Celtics select Al Jefferson from Prentice High School.
He originally intended to go to the University of Arkansas, but instead Jefferson decided to unleash his unique mix of size and agility on the NBA. As most prep-to-pro stars would find out, the transition into professional basketball would prove more physically and emotionally taxing than they ever thought.
You know, getting ready for the season, like training camp and all that stuff, that was probably the most difficult thing. You know, coming from high school, you weren't expected to play in one city, travel and play in another city, and be ready and be expected to play your best.
We're talking training camps full of grown men worried that you might be there to take their job, their livelihood, away from them. Seemingly endless practices, constant travel across the country. This was nothing like the small gyms and short trips that defined his senior year at Prentice High School. In contrast, the newest addition to the Charlotte Hornets, Frank Kaminsky, spent 4 long years at the University of Wisconsin, an elite Division I program under a tough and old school coach in Bo Ryan. Surely Frank would be prepared for the physical demands of life in the NBA.
It's pretty grueling. Feels like the season started like 2 years ago, so it's been a long year, but you know, I'm doing what I love to do.
Even a 4-year college star eventually succumbs to the toll that the NBA unleashes on the body, and that doesn't surprise Al Jefferson one bit.
You catch the rookies, you sleep before you even leave the arena when you're on the way to the airport, you know, because they're just not used to it. That's why we call it the rookie wall.
You want me on that wall. You need me on that wall.
We're going to build the wall.
Ah, yes, the infamous, possibly mythical rookie wall. Not just reserved for prep prodigies or one-and-done freshman phenoms. Frank Kaminsky has certainly had an up-and-down year statistically, especially his three-point shooting, which has fallen away for weeks at a time. Maybe he did hit the wall, but he's done what some haven't been able to do, and that's get back up. He's still a vital part of the Hornets' rotation, something he feels like staying in school helped him to maintain.
It's really prepared me for this rookie season because that's kind of what it's been like. It's been up and down. I've had good games, I've had bad games, I've had good streaks, bad streaks. So, you know, I've been through it before mentally, and I know how to get through it now.
The mentality, the maturity it takes to play at the highest level is something that was cited as a reason to institute this current age limit enacted in 2006. Though, of those 39 prep stars taken in the draft, more than 70% were able to have extended NBA careers. They weren't all superstars like Kobe Bryant and Kevin Garnett, but they weren't all Corleone Young and Leon Smith either. All right, so what about the current rule? One and done. For those who are able to play in Division I college basketball, even for 1 year, the experience can be extremely rewarding and helpful. Take Hornets starting power forward Marvin Williams. He played 1 year at the University of North Carolina in 2004 and 2005 and helped the Heels win a national championship.
I felt like I was one of those guys that benefited from the one-and-done situation. I learned a ton of things from Coach Williams, from the basketball side, from the professional side. You know, I think his 1 year, his influence on me, you know, was a big reason why I feel like I've had an okay career as a pro.
So, if he learned so much in such a short amount of time, the question lingers. Why not stay longer? Learn more. Be more ready.
I felt like from the situation that I came from, I had to take advantage of it because I had an opportunity to help my family. So many guys don't come from the best situations that are in the NBA today, and they have opportunities to really change their family's lives and take advantage of it.
Huh. So we've looked at this from the angle of physical maturity and the angle of mental maturity. But then there it is, the philosophical. Should an adult, 18 years old, 19 years old, be able to use his gifts to take care of his family? As the NBA engages in labor talks again, flush with new TV money, the subject of extending the age limit even further could come up again. Will it be for the good of the game, or is this a solution in search of a problem? special thanks to Justin Thomas for his help reporting this story. He is probably, if you need to talk to him, he's probably still curled up in a ball sobbing somewhere on Franklin Street over this University of North Carolina loss in the championship game. He's hurting.
Justin, I feel you, bro.
He went. They traveled.
Travel safe. Get back to a safe.
He just wanted to just rush.
He wanted to feel it.
Wanted to rush the
street. Can you blame him, Doug? You were there. You've done it.
I feared for my life. I mean.
You were going to the library, though. That's different.
No, it was crazy. Like, I will never claim to know what a war zone is like. But there was fire. There were.
It's a mass of humanity.
It really was. Like, I always say to people that you're in this crowd that's so big that everyone's moving in all kinds of different directions. And you were not moving. You were being moved.
Mm.
It was
physically.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Not emotionally. That was when they beat Michigan State, I was moved emotionally. But yeah, that's it's an interesting topic. This should players be allowed? I just come back to this idea of who benefits? Who benefits from extending the age limit to 2 years? Why would the NBA are they protecting the owners in the sense of, you know, you want to make the guys that are drafted, make sure that the guys that are draft eligible, that the NBA product does not
mm-hmm.
suffer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't buy that argument because again, the draft is a crapshoot. It's a gamble. Everything's a gamble.
They're always going to be bad picks.
They're always going to be
home runs. And there's always going to be strikeouts. Yeah. So, but do you think, I mean, you talk about the marketing aspect of it, you know, it's free marketing for the NBA to have these guys in college for 1 or 2 years so people know who they are when they come to the NBA. Do you buy that anymore? I mean, I feel like.
But this, it's so different now than in 1995,
right,
where there's whole systems set up still for these prep stars to get them into the right colleges. So, you know, you're going to know if the pipeline were opened back up, you're going to know who these guys are. Like, ESPN's not going to shy away from you the next LeBron James.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
So that's what I'm saying. I don't know. Why would the NBA look out for the NCAA? I don't understand that from that perspective. I just don't. I want to know who benefits, because don't tell me it's about the kids. Just don't tell me that, because I don't believe it's about the money is somewhere. There's a reason.
Right. Well, I think I think some of them would benefit, but the rules are not in place to benefit the kids, right? I mean, that's not the idea behind the rules.
I don't think so. Again, I just look at the crop of kids that went from high school to the NBA, and I go, so many of these guys had decent careers. This is not a situation where it was five or six guys and then the rest were garbage.
And that's not the perception, right?
Exactly.
That's a good point for reading this book too, because it paints that. I mean, it paints the picture from, by the way, all angles, because he does a great job of looking at it from the player perspective, you know, NBA front office perspective, and what they're trying to find in these kids. And I mean, that's the thing that a lot of these kids don't realize, though. I mean, once you get to the NBA, like you pointed out in that piece, Doug, I mean, you're a commodity, right? So like GMA doesn't care, you know, what you went through to get the NBA, and player, you know, the veteran player next to you cares even less. Cause like you said, are you going to take his spot? Are you taking food off of his family's table? So, I mean, it's a whole different world. But do you think there'll be any changes to this next collective bargaining agreement?
I don't see any.
I would be surprised, right?
For the age limit to go away. So yeah, I think best case scenario,
2 years, maybe.
I honestly think the light at the end of the tunnel is the expansion of the D League and the investment that the NBA is obviously making in the D League so that there is some kind of system that people could go to in order to pursue an NBA career that isn't college. But this idea that you got to go to school, that's ridiculous. And it's fueling a lot of this NCAA hypocrisy and nonsense and investigations.
So are you for no age limit, just flat out?
Yeah. Well, I, you know,
I mean, because that's where I would
call
I would
me
err.
Call me a commie pig, pinko liberal, I'm for people having the freedom to work and use their gifts.
I mean, that's where I would go if you're going to go. If that's the easiest cut and dry, right? No age limit. Go earn your money. You're good enough to go to the NBA.
Yeah.
I keep going back to the why. Why would the NCAA then be like, you try to go pursue this profession, so that means you can't then retroactively come back and do this?
It's not necessary. That's the thing, too. It's not necessarily helping the NCAA product immensely. I don't think the one and done. It's not. It's not. I mean, the product is not getting any better because these kids. Maybe it's slightly more marketable. Anyway, well, we got to get to Nick Denning. He's on the Hive Talk Live hotline. Nick, sorry, we got into a little passionate discussion there about prep to pro.
Where do you fall on that, Nick?
Where do you fall, Nick?
I'm all for
right.
I'm all for right, I'm all for getting rid of the age limit. I think it's. Yeah. I mean, you could dance around the idea of maybe a baseball system where they give them a choice. They can go out of college, then go out of high school, or maybe if they go to college, they get a certain amount of time. But Doug, I really liked your point about the D League. I think the expansion of the D League could really open up a good avenue for some of these high school players to be able to play professionally. They would be playing professionally, obviously not at the NBA money levels, but you know, it gets them into an NBA system, you know, gets them linked to the team. That's something I think that I'd hope to see more of in the future if they're going to keep the 1 year in place.
All right, Nick, you're here to tell us a little bit about what's going on in the National Basketball Association. It's time for What's Happening Around the NBA. Nick, start us off.
Well, I was going to start with Thon Maker, but it seems you guys have touched on this a lot.
That's
I will say that
it is
that's
Maker. Okay, good.
Nailed
yes,
it.
There
yeah,
we
yeah.
go.
I, at least I think so. anyways, so what I'll say is about Thon is, you know, if the NBA decides that he is eligible, this could potentially change the ways we interpret like what makes someone eligible. Because I mean, this whole idea of prep school, like, does that? I mean, some people view it as a fifth year of high school, but you know, Thon's camp saying is no. This is all this doesn't count. He graduated high school in June of 2015, so this ruling could potentially affect how future high school prospects, you know, decide whether or not to go to the college or maybe the pros. Heat rookie Josh Richardson, that's on another note, was named Eastern Conference Rookie of the Month for the month of March. In 15 games, he led East rookies in scoring with 12 points a game and assists at 2.1. And he shot 53.7%. This is pretty interesting because, like, Richardson was the 40th pick in the draft. This is not a name I don't think any of us expected to be, you know, even in the conversation for Eastern Conference Rookie of the Month. So, you know, kudos to the Miami Heat. You know, that obviously he's not their most prized, you know, pick from this last draft, but certainly something to get excited about considering the month he had. Final note, I mean, this is being talked about a lot, but I think it's obviously we got to talk about it here. The Golden State Warriors are 69-8. They have to go 4-1 to break the record. They have games against Minnesota tonight and then two games against San Antonio and two games against Memphis. So I'm going to pose this to you guys. ESPN's BPI rankings give them a 55% chance of winning 73 games. Do you think that they will break the record?
Yes.
Yes. Because I just think even though Steve Kerr, he can come out all day long and say that they're going to rest players and that they're going to do this and do that. But Mike Conley's now out for the rest of the year for Memphis.
How is Memphis still playing?
I don't know. San Antonio is – although, look, they won with like a scraps crew that against who was it? They beat LeBron. They beat the Cavs, didn't they? Anyway, so yeah, they beat the Cavs with like their second and a half unit. But I just see whatever talent that they end up throwing out there night to night. I don't think they're going to rest, you know, three or four guys at a time. I just think that they have enough to get over the line.
And I think the Spurs are more or less fine with that two seed. They're not gonna catch the Warriors. They're not gonna do anything else than where they are right now. So there's no real motivation for them to go all out. And
if you're the Spurs, I know this is ridiculous, and Pop would probably headbutt me for saying this, but if you're the Spurs, do you really want to piss the Warriors off? by beating them and keeping them from the record.
Well, I think there's something to be said for being able to beat them, but they already beat them.
But
so.
What I'm saying, but if you get them angry, it's like just teasing a bull. Like, well, you know you're probably going to face them in the playoffs anyway. Just let the bull go and then try to regroup and figure it out.
And I think more to that, they don't want to show anymore.
I'm telling you, if I ever said that in front of Greg Popovich, he would hit me in the groin. Right in the groin, because it's so ridiculous.
So that's two yeses from us, Nick. What do you think?
I think they will too. I don't think it's gonna be. You guys seem to feel pretty confident about this. My thing, like, San Antonio is not gonna roll over no matter what kind of team they put out there. But I will say that I think it'd be even more satisfying for San Antonio to let the Warriors get the record and then beat them in the playoffs. Like, that would be like, hey, you got your record, but hey, we're the ones going to the NBA Finals. Memphis, like, the last game of the season is against Memphis. If Golden State goes into that game with 72 wins, Memphis is not – the guys on that team are going to, like, not let that – they're not going to make it easy. I mean, we could get a couple of hard fouls. I mean, just imagine the drama, just the craziness that game could possess. Because even though the Memphis has lost, like, six straight, I mean, they could potentially find themselves out of the playoffs very quickly here. I don't think they're going to want to be the team that lets the Warriors break the record. So I don't know. It'll be interesting.
But they care. That's the difference in my mind. They care. They want the record. They, if Steph has a chance at 400, he says he's chucking. Like, they want the records. They want to put them. They recognize that you only get one shot at this. You know, this thing we call life, and you have to take full advantage of it.
Man.
There was this whole culture that went through sports. It's like, championships mean everything. We must get the championship. And I'm glad to see that fading away. Like, if you have a chance at an epic record, go for it. It makes things exciting.
I will. Okay. I'll go for it, Doug.
It's been a very emotional day for me.
We're all over the place.
Well, you know, the UNC loss has just got me. It's very – look, if you have an opportunity to win a ball game, go win it.
I want winners.
Nick, I want to go back. This is something I mentioned in the 5 o'clock alarm this morning, but I want to go back to the Josh Richardson thing, because you see Miami taking advantage of a second-round pick, and then the Hornets face off against the Raptors tonight. Their second-round pick, Norman Powell, is making waves for that team. Do you think, Nick, that the Hornets and Rich Cho specifically should start to put a little more onus now that they have a D-League team or will have one next season, should put more onus on the second round instead of trading those picks away to try to get one of these gems like Norman Powell or Josh Richardson?
Yes. With the inclusion of the Swarm next season, I think now, like, this should be more of a priority. Up until this season, I would have said no, because I think what Cho has figured out is that he can use these second-round picks and, you know, bring in some, you know, a quality player that helps them in the immediate. I think Trader Cho, you know, trades that we love to throw around here that he's done, that we've said these are brilliant moves, they've come because, you know, he's been able to sort of dangle those second-round picks. But no, I think with the Swarm now, you got to take some chances you got to use the second round picks. You got to find guys that could potentially turn out to be gems and let them develop in the D League. It just can't all be, you know, your fringe guys on the current roster and then just a collection of other guys. I mean, just see what you can do with some of those second round picks.
Well, let's move on to this Toronto game. Again, they tip off at 7:30 in Toronto, the Air Canada Center. David, any matchups you're watching for this game?
Toronto. You know what I'm interested to see in the playoffs for Toronto is Bismack Biyombo.
You want to see Drake?
Bismack Biyombo.
Drake.
I think it's just cool for him to get in. The Hornets are in now. He's in now. They're not together. But he's played well for them up there.
And, you know, it's funny. I think letting Biz go was kind of a key for the Hornets to move in a different direction and get to the playoffs, and Biz leaving the Hornets ended up being his ticket. Yeah. Because he's playing such a significant role off the bench and a specific role. Like, he has a function on that team. Whereas I think the Hornets always needed him to do a little more than he could do, whereas it seems like the Raptors, even though he's developed offensively, I think, but the Raptors seem to be okay with him doing what he does best.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree there. I've said this before, but I think I always felt that Biz's best years, like the Hornets would not get Biz's best years, that they'd be somewhere else. And we're seeing that right now, you know. I'm really happy for him. I'm really happy. And I'm happy that, you know, I think our managing editor, Josh, gets to watch him play in Toronto. You know, at least someone gets to reap the rewards of Bismack Biyombo playing well.
Yeah.
I'll definitely be rooting for him. I'll be rooting for him tonight. Just hopefully the Hornets, you know, get the win rather than even if he has a good game.
Yeah, I call Josh after every Raptors game, and I just say, tell me about Biz.
What's he up to?
How did he do tonight? Explain it, but like really slowly.
Is he happy?
All right, yeah. Keys to the game, guys. Do we have any keys to this game playing Toronto? Again, the last game all the way back in January 1st, the rosters were a lot different, but Toronto was red hot from beyond the arc, and they pulled down 20 offensive rebounds. What are your keys to the game tonight?
For me, I'm looking for – I think Kemba Walker is going to have to get back to that Kemba March form. He got it back to a little bit versus the Cavs. He always seems to gear up, curiously enough, for the Raptors. So he usually plays well against them. Kyle Lowry going head-to-head with him. But that backcourt up there is so good. But I think Kemba, especially without Batum, is going to have to give him maybe 30 tonight for them to have a shot up there.
Nick, your keys to the game.
Oh, yeah, so I was going to say, you know, you got to contain DeMar DeRozan. He's averaging 27 a game against the Hornets this season. They've been able to sort of temper Lowry a little bit. So I think if they can just contain DeRozan just a little bit more, and it's going to be harder now with Batum out, but, you know, Lee will probably get the assignment, and, you know, Lee's been able to play pretty good perimeter defense since he joined the Hornets. So, you know, we do have a guy who I think could potentially, you know, contain DeRozan a little bit.
Injury update, no Nick Batum for this game. Of course, that left knee sprain that took him out of the second half against the Cavaliers in the Hornets' last game, although we did get word that the injury is not very serious. So we're not talking about a Jimmy Butler-type out 4 weeks knee sprain. It's more, I think, of a day-to-day, but he will not play in this game against Toronto. And I think that, you know what, I think that's a savvy move. Maybe he could play, but I think it's a savvy move to keep him away from Toronto, because Toronto, every time the Batum plays against Toronto, they start licking their lips and looking a little looking a little too hard at Nick Batum.
Keep it moving,
buddy. Don't be thinking about free agency and Nick Batum. You just keep on walking.
Oh my God.
So was that too much? I'm sorry. I'm a jealous fan. I'm sorry. No Nick Batum, but the Hornets will get Al Jefferson back from that quad injury, the injury to his right quad. So they do have Al Jefferson. I expect him to play some significant minutes, and that's good, I think, for the Hornets, because the one thing that Toronto can bring in their first and their second unit is size. And they play with a lot of it. And so not having Nick Batum on the wing definitely hurts the Hornets in terms of size, but being able to bring in big Al Jefferson versus Bismack Biyombo and forcing him to play, you know, inside, I think could be.
I like it, Doug. Big Lin game. Looking for a big game for Lin, maybe.
I would hope so. He didn't play in the last one against Toronto. So he'll be, I'm sure, juiced and ready to go. And yeah, I mean, guard play is going to be huge. Shooting is going to be huge.
Shooting is key. Shooting is key.
Well, outside shooting.
Hey, I have a question for you guys. Mm-hmm. Is Marvin, is he going to attempt a third Thunder dunk tonight?
I hope so. For the children's sake. They need to get excited for these playoffs.
He's getting the spry. I mean, he almost got that one to go down. Who was that on? Thompson? In Cleveland?
Thompson.
Yeah.
All right, Nick, thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.
Yeah, thank you.
Nick Denning at The High. Follow him on Twitter at Nicholas Denning. Or no, at Nick Denning. I always get confused because he's Nicholas Denning on SB Nation. All right, that'll do it.
Thanks for sticking with me tonight, Doug, for real.
Hey, no worries.
It's
Listen,
been crazy.
This is all about
I left you hanging
support.
This morning.
We're all in this together. We're on this journey to the playoffs together.
And you folks, of course. If you're still listening, God bless you.
Yeah. Let me play the right outro here as we sign this one off. Enjoy the game tonight, folks. Hornets-Raptors, this is a big one. Away game, opportunity for the Hornets to really make a statement in Toronto. That'll do it for us. Thanks so much to our guest, Jonathan Abrams. Go buy his book, Boys Among Men. Learn something. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Hive Talk Live. Go to atthehive.com for all the latest news and analysis. For David, Nick, and producer Katie, I'm Doug saying stay bought in, stay believing. We're almost there, folks. All hail the teal and purple.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.